So it's just interesting that, you know, nature invented compounds like these, and these are widespread in nature, but somehow she never bothered to add an ammonia to these and come up with these. It took a synthetic chemist to come along and do that. I don't know. Maybe nature just never thought of it, or there was perhaps some other reason.
Maybe he was part of ancient.
Well, yes, and that also is a fact, right? This controversy about, you know, synthetic versus natural is really attempts in a teapot, in my opinion, because as someone said, you know, nature did synthesize the aforementioned synthetic chemists, right? We shouldn't lose sight of that. So anyway, that just illustrates the kind of the variety from the standpoint of the aromatic amino acids, kind of the structural varieties and types of compounds that you get just within that class, just coming off the shikimic acid derivatives. And you could basically say the same thing for any of these other classes, the terpenes or the acetogenins or, you know, these other classes. So one of the understanding now is that these are not secondary compounds, that these actually do function in the day-to-day economy of the plant in terms of modifying the plant's relationship to its external environment. It's this biosynthesis for behavior paradigm that we're talking about. And the functions of these plant allele chemicals are defense and or symbiosis, or semiosis, in other words, a signaling function, stay away or come closer, you know, or symbiosis. And really, these functions overlap. For example, an example of both the semiotic function and the symbiotic function is found in plants' relationship to insects, where the fragrance of the flower and the color of the flower acts as an attractant to the insect. You know, so the plant basically sends out a signal, come closer and become involved, but also it enables the insect to play a role in completing the plant's life cycle. The plant cannot pollinate itself. It needs the insect to help it, at least these particular flowering plants. So this is, you know, it's by virtue of the chemicals that the plant produces that it establishes this symbiotic and semiotic relationship to the insects. This is an example of a defensive chemical. This is Peroia hirsuta that Dr. Schultes has written about quite interestingly. This plant causes in Peru a phenomenon called the Supai Chakra, the devil's clearing, where this plant grows in primary rainforest for about 20 to 40 feet around it. Nothing grows. Actually, selaginella grows, but nothing else. And the thinking is that this plant probably secretes a compound into the soil, either from the leaves or from the roots, that inhibits the growth of other plants, in that inhibits germination. So this is a defensive function. The plant is basically staking out its territory and preventing potential competing plants from moving in on its space. So it's basically saying, stay away, you know, I'm toxic. This plant is chemically unstudied, as far as I know, at least it was a few years. Do you know Dr. Schultes? It's never been examined chemically, but it's in the Rubiaceae, which is a family that's very well known for its biodynamic compounds. So there's potentially some interesting chemistry to be uncovered. This is another example of a true symbiotic relationship. Sorry for the quality of the slide, but the butterfly who pollinates certain plants, and actually certain types of butterfly known on as widespread, probably the best studied example are butterfly of the monarch type, which feed on milkweeds. Milkweeds are full of class of compounds called cardiac glycosides. They're steroids, so they belong to the class of terpenoids. But they're highly toxic. But butterfly has evolved enzymatic defenses against it. The butterfly, or actually the caterpillar, is able to feed on this plant with impunity. Not only does it feed on it, but it takes the cardiac toxins into its body and sequesters them in its body. And it itself is not poisoned by them, but when it transforms itself into a butterfly, it puts the plant toxin to use as a chemical defense. It becomes unpalatable to potential predators. And they can see these butterflies. They have learned that, you know, certain butterflies of this class don't taste good because they're full of these cardiac glycosides. So this is an example of an even more baroque, if you will, relationship, chemically mediated relationship between the plants and the animals, where the consumer of the plant has evolved a biochemical defense against the toxin, and then goes one step further and uses the toxin for its own defensive purposes. Well, the tryptamines and beta-carbolines provide a good illustration. There are a class of compounds that we're very interested in here because we're interested in psychoactive plants, but they also provide a very good illustration of the, which you might call the parsimony of nature. These compounds tend to have multiple activities depending on what biological targets they interact with. It's not just that they're hallucinogens. They're hallucinogens given that nervous systems are the biological targets they interact with, but they also interact on many other levels. These are the tryptamines up here, the beta-carbolines down here. And for example, these beta-carboline alkaloids are, in the presence of UV light, many of them are photoactive. And that's what's shown here. If you take something like 6-hydroxyharmalan or harmine, put a little bit on a filtered paper disc, and put that on a petri plate which has been covered with yeast or E. coli bacteria, and incubated in the dark, nothing happens. The bacteria grows just fine. But if you expose it to UVA, I believe, or UVB, I forget which, for about 10 minutes and then incubate it in the dark, you get a nice clear zone around the filter paper disc where the bacteria has been killed. It hasn't grown due to the photoactivity of these beta-carbolines. And you can do, you know, reasonably nice structure-activity relationships and that sort of thing. But, this explains possibly one of the allelochemical functions of beta-carbolines for the plant. You know, in the presence of sunlight, it might help to defend it against bacteria or fungi that might otherwise invade the plant through the leaves or the roots. Another example with the tryptamines, indole-acetic acid, remember we talked about, is a major plant growth hormone. As you can see, it bears a pretty close structural resemblance to our favorite dimethyltryptamine, 5-hydroxy-DMT, and bufotenine, these psychoactive methylated tryptamines. But it turns out that these, if you treat plants with them, these are found in plants like Desmanthus illinoisensis in the roots. And where they were first discovered and why they were discovered in there is they were looking at plant growth inhibitors. This is a good plant growth inhibitor, and they isolated the fraction responsible and found that it was dimethyltryptamine and other related tryptamines. So at this level, these compounds function as plant growth inhibitors. That is their target. That is their ecological function, probably for the weed, Desmanthus illinoisensis. It probably didn't evolve it so that we could go out and gather it and extract it and make ayahuasca analogs out of it. The same tryptamines in other plants, such as Varolas, though when the organism being interacted with are human, such as these Yanomami Indians, then the target for the tryptamine becomes the central nervous system. And you get the activity that we're familiar with, the hallucinogenic activity. So I guess the point of this is that the compounds can have multiple activities depending on what molecular or biological target they actually interact with. It's not that they have only one kind of activity. So nature makes good use of these things. They are multipurpose compounds. And the reason that these allelochemicals have these multiple activities, can target multiple biological, can mediate multiple biological relationships in nature, is because of the variety of molecular targets that they interact with. For instance, the photoactivity of the baby cartilagins that we saw with the bacteria is due to the fact that they are able to insert themselves between the base pairs of DNA. And they do that, and then in the presence of UV light, they form covalent cross-links with the base pairs of the DNA, which is basically like throwing a big monkey wrench in DNA. So they pretty well, you know, inactivate the cellular processes at that point. In the absence of light, they don't do this, but in the presence of the right wavelength of light, this can happen. So the beta carbolines do this, but only if in the right milieu and under the right circumstances. Another class of compounds that do the same thing are also derived from plant. They're called the sorolins. And I don't know if you've heard of PUVA therapy, but it's a kind of treatment for psoriasis where you take sorolin pills for several days. It accumulates in your body and in your skin, and then you go into a tanning salon and you get an all-over tan under UV lights, and it causes the cross-links the DNA in the outer surface of your skin and causes that to slough off. So you come out of it looking all pink and healthy, and then gradually the psoriasis comes back and you have to do it again. It was for a while a promising treatment for psoriasis, the heartbreak of psoriasis. I don't know if it's still being used. And it really is a heartbreak. I mean, it's a serious condition, you know, in advanced cases. Another example of phototoxicity, I mean, the example there is the target, in the case of the beta carbolines, is DNA. It basically throws a monkey wrench into DNA. But cell membranes are another important biological target for these active plant allelochemicals. This is an example. This used to be a red blood cell. Before it was exposed to a compound called alpha-tryptyanil, which is a photoactive sulfur derivative found in marigolds. And in the presence of UV light, alpha-tryptyanil sequesters itself in the membrane. It's highly lipophilic. It's highly fat-soluble, so it dissolves in the membrane. It literally blows holes in the membrane. So that's what you're seeing here. These craters are literally, the thing is riddled with holes, and of course it's lost its osmotic tone. So another photoactive compound, but a completely different mechanism of action. It works on membranes instead of DNA. Another example of biological targets are enzymes of different kinds. And again, we can illustrate from the beta carbolines. The beta carbolines are potent monoamine oxidase inhibitors. They inhibit the enzyme that deaminates neurotransmitters such as 5-hydroxytryptamine. Beta carbolines block that enzyme. So at that level, they're working on, I mean, that becomes the target for them. This, of course, underlies the pharmacological mechanism behind ayahuasca. Ayahuasca, is I'm sure all of you know, is a combination of two plants, at least two, one of which contains beta carbolines, the Banisteriopsis, and the other one, the admixture plant, contains dimethyltryptamine. Dimethyltryptamine, taken orally by itself, is not active, because it's inactivated by monoamine oxidase, which is present in peripherally in your stomach, in your liver, and so on. But if you take it in the presence of a beta carboline, the beta carboline inhibits MAO and protects the DMT from peripheral breakdown, allowing it to be absorbed into the nervous system in the intact state. So this particular action of beta carbolines, the ability to inhibit monoamine oxidase, becomes important in the human interaction with these two plants that have led to ayahuasca and all the ayahuasca analogs that people are now experimenting with. Another example of an important biological target are second messenger systems. Second messengers are enzymes, usually, such as protein kinase and adenylate cyclase. They're enzymes that are usually found to membranes that mediate what you can call kind of generically a post-binding events. They're second messengers. They govern intracellular processes, usually that follow on the binding of a drug or a neurotransmitter to a receptor. And one of the classes of compounds that are one of the most potent inhibitors of second messengers are called 4-mol esters, found in the family Euphorbiaceae. They're very potent activators of a protein called protein kinase C. Kinase C is involved in, and one of the reasons that 4-mol esters are highly carcinogenic is because of their action on protein kinase C. Okay, so the sort of the point of that is that these plant allelochemicals, these biologically active secondary compounds, have these activities because they interact with some kind of receptor. They have to get in and bind with something in order to do what they do. Now, you can take the term receptor in a sort of broad sense, where a receptor is anything that a drug binds to exert its effect. It might be an enzyme, it might be a membrane carrier molecule, it might be a nucleic acid. All of these are in some sense receptors, in the sense that these biodynamic molecules can bind to them and affect them by doing so. Receptors and their ligands, that's what we call the molecules that bind to the receptors, are a complex chemical communication system that regulates the internal homeostasis of the organism by governing this signaling between cells, systems of cells, and even other organisms. And it may, the speculation is, how did we end up with all these internal receptors? The speculation is that these receptors originally served an ecological function, that they originally were found on the outsides of organisms, and that the biosynthetic diversity we observe in the natural world is the evolutionary consequence of billions of years of this biochemical or chemical ecological warfare. Part of one component is the elaboration of these defensive or aggressive or symbiotic allelochemicals on the part of the plants. The organisms that they're targeted to in turn evolve adaptations, adaptive responses to neutralize them, detoxify them, or counterattack in some way. And then the plants respond with biosynthesis of even more novel, even more complex molecules with even complex modes of biological activity. And as multicellular organisms became more complex, this interchange between organisms, which is basically organisms synthesizing and excreting these compounds into the environment, they travel to other organisms. We're talking about largely one-celled organisms and interacting with receptors on the outside of the cells. But as organisms became more complex and multicellular, these receptor systems gradually became internalized. And the signaling functions, instead of transmitting between organisms, then became adapted to transmitting signals between populations of cells within an organism. So you get hormones and neurotransmitters, which are basically our own ecological chemicals that have been adapted to this internal function, but they were originally there to mediate relations between organisms in an ecosystem. That's how they arose, and then as they became adapted to this internalized function, they became specialized to that kind of activity.
This is a typical neurotransmitter receptor, which is sort of more the what we think of conventionally when we think of a receptor. This is sort of the narrow definition of a receptor. And this happens to be a serotonin receptor, but any neurotransmitter receptor incorporates much the same processes. In this case, you've got tryptophan, which is the essential amino acid, right, off the Shikimin pathway. And that is transformed within the presynaptic membrane into 5-hydroxytryptamine, 5-or-serotonin, as it's also called. That is stored in membrane-bound vesicles until it's used. And when it's used, these vesicles migrate to the membrane of the cell, and the neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft. Then various things happen to it. It travels across to the postsynaptic membrane, and it interacts with one or more different types of serotonin receptors on the postsynaptic membrane. The 5-HT2 receptors, the 5-HT1 receptors are just shown, but there is now, I think there's getting up to be at least 8 different subtypes of serotonin receptors alone. And every neurotransmitter, dopamine, GABA, all these things have their own receptor subtypes. So it's quite a complex picture, really. And then, once they bound to these membrane, these receptors, these specific receptors located on the membrane, it activates second messengers and subsequent events take place. Once the neurotransmitter has done its work, it's taken back up into the presynaptic membrane through a carrier molecule. This is yet another kind of receptor. And recycled, it's either recycled, repackaged into the membrane-bound vesicles and reused, or at that point it may also be degraded by monoamine oxidase and turned into 5-hydroxyamino-acetic acid in this case. Now, psychoactive drugs, those that work on the central nervous system, tend to do their job by affecting one or more of these processes that are taking place at the receptor site and in the vicinity of the synapse. They either affect the synthesis, the storage, the release, the receptor binding, or the reuptake, or the degradation of the neurotransmitter. That's how they do their job. For instance, recipine, the alkaloid from the Indian snake root, basically disrupts these vesicles and causes the 5-HT to be released into the cytoplasm and sort of leak out of the cell. So actually, it's not selected for only serotonin. It doesn't draw your monoamine-type neurotransmitters. But it depletes the presynaptic cell of its neurotransmitters. That's what the serotonin does. Your hallucinogens, the so-called true hallucinogens, LSD, psilocybin, these ones, it's now thought to interact primarily with the 5-HT2 receptor. In other words, they substitute for serotonin at the 5-HT2 receptor. They also affect some of the 5-HT1 receptors, but that's not quite so well understood. Antidepressant drugs such as Prozac is a very selective blocker of the serotonin reuptake molecule. It gets in here, prevents the serotonin from binding to this and being taken back up into the cell, with the result being that there's a higher amount, a higher availability of serotonin in the synaptic cleft. Prozac is, you know, typical antidepressant in that respect, and a marvel of structure activity engineering because it is so selective for serotonin. So this is this table is undoubtedly hard to read, but this just shows some of the natural products that affect the nervous system. The compound, its chemical class, its pharmacological action, and its therapeutic application. And basically, I think the point of this slide is that you can't think of an activity, a pharmacological activity, for which there is not a natural product. that shows that somehow affect those receptors or those mechanisms involved in that activity. And you could put the same kind of slide up for any type of, any class of activity. If you're interested in the liver function, you could construct a similar one for the liver. If you're interested in antimicrobial activity, you could just construct a similar one for antimicrobial activity. Notice in the case of the central nervous system compound, how many of these are alkaloids. Alkaloids are disproportionately represented when it comes to the central nervous system activity. It's something about the presence of that nitrogen that gives them the ability to interact with these receptor systems that are so important in the functioning of the nervous system. But any class of activity that you can name as an actual product that displays the activity, this is, you know, physostigmine inhibits cholinesterase. Reserpine depletes CNS monoamines. THC says it's psychoactive, but you know, one of the exceptions, it's not an alkaloid. It doesn't have nitrogen. So it's kind of interesting. Nature has evolved these allelochemicals that interact with receptors that we haven't discovered yet, which is kind of interesting. I mean, we've seen a classical example of this in Salvinorin. I mean, the work that's been described here is very interesting. A compound has been identified. It has definite psychoactivity, and we at the moment don't have a clue what receptor system it might interact with, except we're pretty sure it's probably not 5-HT2. You know, I mean, there are speculation, but that's partly the importance of natural products. Because of the importance of natural products in drug discovery is that this molecular diversity, out of looking at the molecular diversity of natural products, you get new chemical entities come out, and they point the way to new modes of pharmacological activity. I mean, you can make, you know, many phenethylamine derivatives, many tryptamine derivatives, and that's all very well, but you're looking basically, with subtle differences, you're looking basically at a characterized mode of activity. We know pretty much that it involves the 5-HT2 receptors. Some of these new molecules that are coming out of the natural world point the way, may open the door to completely new pharmacologies. Dr. Schultes, a few years ago, wrote an article, which has been not widespread at all. It was called Phytochemical Gaps in Our Knowledge of Hallucinogens. And I think it was published in a very obscure journal, the Journal of Plant Science or something like that. And I always thought that it was, I mean, of his many very significant papers, I always thought it was one of the most significant, because he pointed out in there, it was a description of about 30 plants for which the ethnobotanical documentation was clear. No doubt that there was probably activity there because people were using it and they were experiencing effects from it in different traditional societies. But there was no information on the chemistry. And I wished that he had called it Phytochemical Gaps in Our Knowledge of CNS Active Plants, because it would have gotten a lot more attention, and it might have induced some of these drug companies to look into these plants more. By calling it Phytochemical Gaps in Our Knowledge of Hallucinogens, they said, oh, wow, who needs another hallucinogen? You know what I mean? But as we show with Salvinorin and these sorts of things, you never know what these things may end up being used. You can't dismiss these. Well, this is another example, just another out-of-focus example of the varieties of CNS activity that you get in the natural world. This is a table that I put together from NaturAlert. Some of you have heard me talk about NaturAlert. It's a natural products database created by Norman Farnsworth at the University of Illinois. And among the things that it talks about are different classes of pharmacological activity. I went into NaturAlert and I asked it, if I specify these types of central nervous system activity, analgesic, anesthetic, local in general, anorexic, drug addiction, inhibition, learning enhancement, hallucinogenic. You know, I say in macrolert, how many hits are there for each of these types of activity? How many plants are reported to have these different types of activity? So it's the number fact, right? Analgesic, 3,710 citations for plants with analgesic activity. Hallucinogenic activity, not bad, 88 citations. Anesthetic activity, 226 citations. Tranquilizing effects, 260 citations. And I guess what the point of this is that there are indications of activity far more extensive than have been looked at.